This is Al. Hello, this is Al Reynolds. From the Triangle Radio Reading Service, for the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated November 18th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. On the front page, top of the fold, NC Going to Bid State Health Plan, by Jason DeBrun, from Raleigh. Administration of the state health plan will go out for bid in early 2012, the first open bid since 2006 for a massive insurance program that paid out $2.5 billion in net claims last year. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina has held the contract to administer the plan for nearly every year since the General Assembly outsourced it in 1972. Jack Kenley, Blue Cross Blue Shield, NC, Vice President, is in charge of the plan, says BSBC, has enjoyed a long relationship with the state and hopes to continue that. It's our largest account, he says. We embrace the bid process. Representatives of United Healthcare and Aetna did not return calls for comment. Senator Austin Allran, a Republican from Hickory, says soliciting new bids is a good idea. I don't really know why there would be a disadvantage of shopping around a little bit, he says. It seems to me some competition, or a lot of competition, would be a good thing. Officials of the state health plan, which will fall under the North Carolina Department of State Treasurer next year, would not give any details about the bid. Treasurer spokeswoman Julia Vail said only that state health plan staff have been working around the clock for some time to develop this RFP, or Request for Proposals, which is expected to be in development until its tentative release date in February. The plan covers 664,000 state employees, which includes teachers. And last fiscal year, which ended in June 30th, the state paid $1.8 billion in net medical claims and $656 million in net pharmacy claims, which are processed through Medco. In total, the plan came in $107 million under the authorized budget. Unlike a traditional insurance program with monthly premiums, Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina manages the state health plan, but the state pays the bills. Every month there is a reconciliation payment in which the state and Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina settle up, says Kenley. Last year, the state paid Blue Cross Blue Shield North Carolina $110 million in administrative expenses, which accounted for 66% of the plan's total administrative expenses. The state paid Medco $19 million in the same type of fees, or 11% of the total. For a short time in the early 1980s, electronic data systems took over the medical contract, and Allran says he would just as soon forget those days. That was an absolute disaster, Allran, who has served 16 terms in the General Assembly, says. EDS, which was founded by Ross Perot, was very strict on paying claims, and Allran says he remembers regularly dealing with constituents who could not get a claim paid. As for Blue Cross Blue Shield, Allran says the company is almost too liberal in some of their payments. One complaint is they are too easily to pay and overpay, Allran says. As if to provide an example, a state audit released in September found that the state health plan had overpaid Wake Forest University Baptist Hospital some $1.34 million. Looking ahead to the new bid, Kenley says he has no clue what's going to be in that RFP, but hopes it includes an open-ended portion to allow insurance companies to offer additional services. The bid request will likely have a certain number of required services, which companies will bid on, and it might include an option for further services. Next up, Credit Unions Bag New Business, by Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. The flight to credit unions apparently won't be a flash in the pan. The opening of new accounts at Raleigh-based State Employees Credit Union and other area credit unions is continuing to run at rates above normal, even after major banks abandoned plans to levy fees on the use of debit cards. credit unions across the state added more than 26,000 checking accounts and more than $180 million in deposits in October during the height of the fee controversy and bank transfer day on November 5th, a movement that grew out of social media chat and gained the backing of the credit union industry. At a national level, National Credit Union Association spokesman Patrick Keefe says that while a huge spike recorded in October, 650,000 new accounts bringing in $4.5 billion, isn't sustainable, the industry is on track to add 1 million new clients by year's end, an increase of 54%. Maybe we've seen a shift, he says. The rate of new credit union signups has waned somewhat in November, but is still running at 16% above historical levels at CQ, State Employees Credit Union, says President James Blaine, who says he sees the transfers as a positive statement about credit unions rather than a negative statement about banks. We hope they're coming here for reasons other than that the credit union has a better price, he says. We like to think it's because we are socially responsive and that we are different. State Employees Credit Union, the nation's second-largest credit union with 1.7 million members and $23 billion in total assets, normally averages 11,000 new accounts a month. In October, it added 12,760. Raleigh-based local government Federal Credit Union, which normally adds 1,305 accounts per month, saw that number rise by 46% to 1,903 in October during the fee controversy. Transfer day data won't be available until December, but LGFCU spokeswoman Erica Hinton says the organization expects to see the bump continue. We expect some momentum from that to carry on for a while, she says. Many bank customers feel they were thrown for a loop, so we think they will continue to reassess their banking relationships and look into their options. Jeff Harden of the North Carolina Credit Union League, a trade group, says scattered reports from credit unions across the state indicate that the above-normal sign-ups are continuing. Blaine, for one, believes the shift began well before the fee flap. Back in January 2011, he says, CQ made the decision to streamline the procedures used in switching a checking or savings account from a bank over to the credit union. The result was an easy-to-use package called a switch kit. Propelling the move, he says, were reports from the CQ Community Advisory Board that wider consumer sentiment was beginning to run against banks because of the overall pullback of credit. The fee controversy just accelerated it, says Blaine. CQ went to its rolls and offered the switch kits to 100,000 members, people who belong to credit unions and even borrowing from it but still maintain primary checking and savings accounts in a bank. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, charging for the road, electric vehicles and keeping them moving is now a reality, by Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Triangle car dealers, energy companies, and even restaurants are charging up the market for electric vehicles with growing sales of cars and a continuing wave of plug-in stations. The city of Raleigh is installing the last in a series of about 30 stations in a project it began in 2010 with federal grant money. After installing several stations elsewhere in the state, a Raleigh-based contractor is preparing to turn homeward with a half dozen charging stations in the city of Oaks at publicly and privately owned buildings. Perhaps most importantly, vehicle sales are finally starting to accelerate. While General Motors Company has very publicly fallen short of its sales goals for the Chevrolet Volt, Nissan Motor Company Limited has sold more than 15,000 of its all-electric Leaf since releasing it a year ago, according to worldwide estimates by Autoblog Green. By comparison, Toyota Motor Corporation sold just 3,000 of its gasoline electric hybrid Priuses in its initial 1997 model year. Local numbers aren't available, but Nissan dealers in the Triangle say they've sold out their initial allotments of Leaf from the manufacturer. At Michael Jordan Nissan in Durham, Internet sales manager Steve Martin says the dealership has sold or leased all three Leafs that have arrived, as well as all 19 that are scheduled to arrive before the end of the year. At $38,000 to $40,000 a pop, the Leaf is still for early adopters, Martin says. Drivers of the electric vehicles say the performance is generally on par with that of gasoline-powered cars. But the Leaf and other electrics won't become common until prices fall, Martin says. A secondary factor is the car's range, Martin and others say. Depending on the number of passengers and the style of driving, the Volt can go just 35 miles before having to fall back on its gasoline engine. The Leaf's range is 3 times that, but it has no backup engine. The limited range is part of what advocates call a chicken-and-egg problem. Which has to come first, the vehicles or a dense network of charging stations to keep electric drivers from getting stranded? But advocates say car sales and car charger installations are accelerating and thus beginning to feed off one another. They're certainly going up much more quickly than people realize, Martin says of the charging stations. Most public charging stations feature 220-volt plugs that can fully charge a car in 3 to 4 hours. The electrical hardware is produced by global giants including General Electric Company, which has a facility in Mebane, and Eaton Corporation, which has a facility near Asheville. The stations are typically located at office buildings, shopping malls, and other places where a driver is likely to stay for at least a couple of hours. CEO Albert Skip Kurz of Praxis Technologies, which is installing 19 charging stations using a $247,000 state Go Green grant, envisions chargers becoming common at restaurants. Currently, a McDonald's on Kildare Farm Road in Kerry has a charging station. In the next few months, Praxis aims to install plug-in stations at North Carolina Department of Transportation facilities, at an office on Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh, and at the new American Institute of Architects building at the intersection of Wilmington Street and Peace Street, just north of downtown Raleigh. For now, most charging stations are free. When operators of the stations do eventually begin to charge for charging, they can't set the cost for electricity itself unless they register as a public utility, an unlikely step. Ann Tazewell, Transportation Program Manager at the North Carolina Solar Center and NC State University, says she believes restaurants and offices with stations will offer premium parking, paid by the minute or hour, with access to a plug. Even so, most charging will continue to be at drivers' homes and use 110-volt plugs, the same power required for lights and most household appliances. Such plugs typically take about 10 hours to fully charge a car. Tazewell says the charging stations are necessarily mainly for long trips and to ease what she calls range anxiety, the fear of forgetting to charge at night and then getting stranded on a cross-town trip. Eliminating that range anxiety altogether is not immediately necessary, she says. We are talking about the very beginning of something that's under very rapid development, says Tazewell. Next up, Greystone Bank may be winding down. By Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. The CEO of specialty business lender Greystone Bank won't comment on the future of the institution, which has shed more than 80% of its total assets and half its staff in the past 15 months. In a recent development, Greystone has also shut down its website. An online presence has been an integral part of the 6-year-old bank's operation in the past. It was via the internet that Greystone marketed certificates of deposits, or CDs, nationwide. CEO David Roop declined to discuss the moves or where Greystone is heading. We are not commenting on that, says Roop. That's where we are. He also declined to talk about whether the bank's web presence would be restored. However, insiders say Greystone, which opened in 2005 by New York businessman Steven Rosenberg, who remains the majority stakeholder, is self-liquidating. Attempts to reach Rosenberg at his office at New York-based Greystone Incorporated and Company were not successful. Since June 2010, the bank had cut its total assets from $504 million to $89 million as of September 30th. Loans have fallen from $351 million to $44 million, and staff declined from 38 to 19. The numbers are those the bank reported to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Greystone operates out of a single office on Raleigh's Falls of the Noose Road and is focused on writing loans for conventional and government-assisted multifamily housing and health care properties and on projects approved by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. As of early 2010, some 80% of the bank's loans were concentrated in multifamily housing and commercial real estate, both sectors that have been slammed in the real estate downturn. Greystone, in turn, experienced a bumpy ride in 2010, posting losses of $17 million for the year, according to the FDIC. Losses through the first 9 months of 2011 have grown to $30 million, according to a September 30 call report submitted by the bank to the regulatory agency. In late February 2011, Greystone signed a consent agreement with the FDIC, agreeing, among other things, to review its lending practices, including timely identification of problem loans. The bank also agreed to beef up its capital ratios and submit new strategic and liquidity plans. Any orderly wind down of the bank now would entail it working through without replacing its final loans and capital base arrangements. It's not a customary bank exit, most of which are ordered and executed by state or federal regulators. I've certainly never heard of it, says bank analyst Don Coker, says of the apparent voluntary wind down. Officials at the Office of the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks declined to comment. It is confidential, and we cannot comment on the matter, says office spokeswoman Hi Nguyen. Next up, Rogers, Duke will add jobs in Charlotte, by John Downey. From Charlotte, while Raleigh is expected to lose as many as 1,000 jobs with the merger of Duke Energy and Progress Energy, Charlotte will end up with a gain in employment, Duke Chief Executive Jim Rogers predicts. By the time the dust clears on the voluntary severance program and the consolidation, there will be more people at Duke and Charlotte than before the merger, he says. The companies have said they expect to cut about 2,000 positions altogether by eliminating duplicative positions. Rogers says some existing positions will be eliminated in Charlotte, but a number of employees who leave the Progress headquarters in Raleigh will move to Charlotte to fill positions in the Queen City, he says. The total number of employees in Charlotte will be more than it is today. Duke's current workforce includes 1,400 to 1,600 employees in Uptown Charlotte and roughly 6,000 in the Charlotte region, company spokesman Tom Scheel says. Precise numbers are hard to come by because workers are still moving into the new Duke Energy Center uptown, and the company has held down its hiring in advance of the merger. Altogether, Duke and Progress have about 29,500 employees. More than 400 of the positions they expect to eliminate after the merger are already vacant. Both companies have been careful about filling positions in the run-up to the merger. Duke and Progress hope to complete their deal by the end of the year, though the timetable could shift into early 2012. Both companies have started accepting volunteers for a severance program that will make a lump sum payment based on salary and years of service, along with providing continued health benefits to selected employees. Eligible workers have until the end of the month to sign up for the program. Duke and Progress executives will begin a review of the volunteers in December to determine who will be offered the buyouts. The companies still hope to eliminate all the positions through the buyouts, but Rogers says it's too early to tell if the response will be strong enough. If there are insufficient volunteers, the post-merger Duke will have to use forced layoff to make its target. Rogers also says it is becoming less likely that the merger will close by the end of the year. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has required Duke to propose actions that would ease the potential for the company to wield anti-competitive power over wholesale power markets in the Carolinas. And the FERC may not act on Duke's proposed solution in time for North Carolina and South Carolina regulators to grant final approval by year-end. This is still our aspiration, Rogers says, of a December closing for the deal, but we are running out of time. What is clear, he says, is that the resolution will involve some variation of the virtual divestiture Duke has proposed. To promote market competition, the company has recommended setting aside capacity from some of its plants to offer the wholesale market during the summer and winter when the demand for power is at its peak. FERC suggested virtual divestiture among the possible solutions to the concerns. It isn't yet clear if Duke's proposal will prove adequate. The lawyer for the cities of New Bern and Rocky Mount, which raised the competition issue, says the cities are not satisfied. The Federal Commission's other possible solutions included having Duke join a regional transmission organization, or RTO, that would promote competition, or requiring the company to sell as much as 800 megawatts worth of power plants to competitors. Those options won't work, Rogers says. The idea of selling 800 megawatts is a non-starter. We need it to meet our demand. And an RTO is a non-starter with the North Carolina Utilities Commission. They aren't going to let us do that. So he expects the resolution to come down to how much virtual divestiture FERC will deem necessary. If the agency accepts Duke's proposal as is, the deal can close by the end of December. But if more negotiations are needed, it will kick into the early next year. Here's an article titled Venture Boost at North Carolina State University. The university is launching a program to nurture startup companies. It's written by Jason DeBruin. Attention all entrepreneurs with an innovation in technology. North Carolina State University wants to help you commercialize your idea. The university has expanded its new venture services group and launched the NC State Fast 15, an initiative to help technology innovators from the university launch a business and take their product or service to market. We have good ideas come out of NC State, but not enough ideas are being converted to commercial reality, says Russell Thomas, who is in charge with helping these innovators take their ideas out of the lab and into the commercial world. The NC State Fast 15 will be 15 startups a year selected for their high growth potential. Thomas estimates the companies could show as much as 30% growth annually. NC State has an ambitious goal, says Terry Lomax, Vice Chancellor in the Office of Research, Innovation, and Economic Development. We want to double the number of startup companies launched by university faculty and students each year. The NC State Fast 15 will help us focus on translating research into real economic opportunities, ultimately creating new companies. More than 80 startup companies over the years have launched out of NC State, including large companies Cree and SAS, but the innovators behind those companies did not receive some of the directed support that NC State's Office of Technology Transfer would like to offer, says Kelly Sexton, Assistant Director for Licensing and Strategic Initiatives. Before the office would help with licensing and acquiring patents, for example, but lack the ability to really help establish a business plan. The piece that's been missing is how to support these nascent companies, Sexton says. Now the office has added Thomas, the director of new venture services. He will, as his title suggests, provide business services to new ventures. Too often faculty or students have great or innovative ideas but don't have the wherewithal to turn the idea into a business, says Sexton. Teams just simply graduated and the ideas evaporated, he says. Thomas might help with the management or help find employees. He could work through licensing procedures or secure a patent for an idea. For some companies, his job will be simply shining the light on them a little more to make potential clients aware they exist, says Thomas. In the case of nanotechnology company Zenify, for example, Thomas says it has a good business structure established and will begin churning out products soon. Now the company's founders need help spreading the word about their market, about their product, which is called Zanoshear and marketed as a simpler way to produce nanofibers, the next generation of textiles. They need exposure, Thomas says, so we are using our communications engine to help create visibility for them. And Sexton says many of these will be the job creators of the future. Next up, Coldwell Real Estate Firms merge to have 600 agents total. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Two of the largest Coldwell Banker real estate franchises in North Carolina will merge to form a company that will stretch from the Triangle south to Fayetteville and east to the coast. It will become the third largest residential brokerage group in North Carolina. Coldwell Banker Advantage of Raleigh, led by President Gary Rabone, and Coldwell Banker Seacoast Realty of Wilmington, led by President Tim Milam, announced the merger at a November 17th meeting at the Northridge Country Club in Raleigh, attended by Coldwell Banker Real Estate CEO Jim Gillespie. Gillespie noted that the merger creates the fifth-largest Coldwell Banker-affiliated company in North America. Coldwell Banker Advantage and Coldwell Banker Seacoast Realty have been two of our top-performing franchisees for a number of years, Gillespie says. The two companies will have a combined 600 real estate agents and 26 offices. The Coldwell Banker Advantage brand name in Raleigh and in Fayetteville will remain unchanged, but the Wilmington and Jacksonville area offices will be rebranded as Coldwell Banker Seacoast Advantage. Rabone and Milam will share duties as co-chief executive officers of the combined companies. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed, but Rabone says a combined company will have an ownership group of 10 members that will include Ralph Huff, CEO of the residential building company H&H Homes of Fayetteville, which Builder magazine ranks as the 51st largest home building company in the country. Huff was also a partner up with the Coldwell Banker Huff and Pennock real estate firm that merged with Advantage in 2009. Milam described the Advantage Seacoast deal as a true merger of equals. Gary and I have been friends for a long time, and we manage our businesses in much the same way, Milam says. Neither company is buying the other. Instead, we are joining forces to compete more effectively in today's challenging marketplace. Both Advantage and Seacoast have been taking advantage of softness in the housing market to expand their footprints through acquisitions of other real estate agencies, and both Rabone and Milam says they expect to continue growing the company through acquisitions. We're very bullish on the market over the next 5 to 7 years, Rabone says. The Fayetteville and Jacksonville areas especially are starting to grow with the military. Rabone says his growth focus in recent years has been in the smaller towns and cities outside Raleigh, where his company is based. We can battle in the big markets, but we tend to do better in the smaller markets, like Henderson, he says. The growth is expanding outside the Triangle, and we're trying to get into places ahead of the curve. Advantage, which Rabone opened in 1990, ranks number 3 in the Triangle market for the number of closed transactions, according to Triangle Business Journal research, and it ranks number 1 in Fayetteville. Seacoast Realty, which was founded in Wilmington in 1988, holds about 23% of the total market share in Wilmington, Brunswick County, Topsail, and Jacksonville, according to multiple listing service statistics. The two companies so far this year have combined for nearly $1.2 billion in sales volume and more than 6,000 transactions, according to trade publication Real Trends. And now, restructuring in the works for two firms acquired by Inventive. Parent hires firm to help reconfigure space for two companies that have 175 employees here. By Amanda Jones Hoyle from Cary. Inventive Health is reevaluating its operations in the Triangle after acquiring three companies in the last 9 months that combined employ about 250 people in Raleigh and Cary. Inventive Health, which is based in Somerset, New Jersey, kicked off the new year with its acquisition of the Campbell Alliance consulting firm in Raleigh in February, followed by two more acquisitions of clinical research companies in June and July. The i3 clinical development business from Ingenix, and the drug development company Pharmanet. Neither i3 nor Pharmanet are based in the Triangle, but both companies have sizable clinical operations in Cary. The company i3 employs about 110 people at its offices in the Weston 1 building in Cary, and Pharmanet employs about 65 people at its office in the Sutter Green office park in Cary. Subsequent to the acquisition's closing in the summer, Inventive Health hired Creasa Partners real estate firm to market for sublease both i3 space at Weston 1 and Pharmanet space at Center Green. The office spaces combined total 80,530 square feet, according to Creasa Partners. Inventive Health spokeswoman Anita Bose says the company is still in the process of integrating its newest acquisitions, and that it had no further details about its reorganization plans. We don't have any clear plans yet that we can share publicly, Bose said. Ed Hull, managing principal of Cresa Partners, office in Cary, says the company is trying to shed its excess real estate space, but that Inventive does not intend to vacate both Cary buildings. Instead, it will likely consolidate the I-3 staff and PharmaNet staff into one of the Cary buildings if a sublease tenant is found for either building. We put both buildings out there to see what interest there was, but they are not going to get rid of both, he says. Hull says the Campbell Alliance headquarters space at Briar Creek Corporate Park in Raleigh will not be affected by the reorganization. Campbell Alliance CEO Nader Naimi Nirad says, who took over the management of the company from Campbell Alliance founder John Campbell in September, says he has not had any contact with any of Inventive's managers regarding I-3 and PharmaNet in Cary. Naimi Rod noted that Campbell, which has 99 employees at its headquarters in Raleigh and 312 full-time employees around the world, operates in a different division from Inventive's newest acquisitions. Inventive realigned its organization in January under three operating segments, clinical, consulting, and commercial. We are still growing here, says Naomi Rod. The lease for the I-3 clinical space at Weston 1 expires in September 2014 and includes 44,114 square feet on the building's second floor. The space includes 42 private offices and 157 workstations. The PharmaNet space at Center Green 5 expires in April 2018 and includes 36,416 square feet on the second and third floors. The space includes 33 private offices and 87 workstations. Inventive Health Incorporated is privately owned by Inventive Group Holdings Incorporated, an organization sponsored by affiliates of Thomas H. Lee Partners, Liberty Lane Partners, and members of the Inventive Management Team. The holding company in August 2010 bought the company's shares that had been trading on the NASDAQ stock exchange in a $1.1 billion acquisition that took the company private. The company estimates that its client roster includes more than 550 pharmaceutical, biotech, and life sciences companies. Inventive paid $376.4 million for I-3 and paid $592.9 million for PharmaNet, according to company files. The financial terms of the Campbell Alliance acquisition were not disclosed. Next up, long climb ahead, but CEO sees $4 billion in future for Salix. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. Salix Pharmaceutical CEO Karen Logan says the drug maker could reach $4 billion in sales in the coming decade, a mark that would make it larger than software giant SAS Incorporated is today. That's a bold prediction given the company's recent financial history. Salix reported a net loss in 12 consecutive months from 2007 to 2010 and a combined net loss of $139 million for the 6 years ending in 2010. In the past 12 months, however, Salix has begun to grab the notice of investors. The company recorded $78 million in net income in that period thanks in part to its top-selling drug, Xifaxan, which accounted for 69% of net revenue for the year and runs at about 90% gross margin, says CFO Adam Derbyshire. Salix also purchased Oceana Pharmaceuticals for $300 million in cash, acquiring that company's top drug, Celesta, which Logan says could reach $500 million in annual sales, a total that would roughly equal Salix's total net product revenue for 2011. Based in Raleigh, Salix makes drugs to treat conditions of the digestive system, technically called gastroenterology. Xifaxan, for example, is approved for treatments of hepatic encephalopathy a condition that occurs when a damaged liver cannot remove the toxins that a healthy liver does, and traveler's diarrhea. The company is seeking approval to market Xifaxan to treat irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, with diarrhea, a condition for which there are no antibiotics currently approved. But Salix hopes to expand Xifaxan's use were dealt a blow on November 15th when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration revealed it had questions about the effectiveness of Xifaxan in treating IBS with diarrhea. After meeting with Salix on November 16th, the FDA allowed for a clinical trial to test Xifaxan for IBS with diarrhea. The trial is set to begin in the early part of 2012. The acquired Salix drug, Celesta, treats fecal incontinence, loss of regular bowel control, and fits among Salix's other gastro products. Fecal incontinence is a significant unmet medical need that affects approximately 15% of people in the United States over the age of 50 and is the leading reason for admission to assisted living facilities in the United States, Logan said during a conference call reviewing third quarter financial results. Celesta is a highly synergistic addition to our product portfolio. Logan touts the acquisition of the drug, saying it will help Salix achieve modest growth in 2012 and high growth thereafter. Derbyshire adds that Celesta would provide Salix with margins in the mid-70% or higher. Despite posting net losses, the market has shown faith in Salix. At points in late 2008, Salix shares were trading below $6. Since then, the stock price rose as high as $49 and is now trading in the $34 range. Salix reported solid third quarter results, says Gary Waterman, an analyst with the Goldman Sachs Group who tracks Salix. He listed Salix in the 90th percentile for both growth and returns and raised his estimates of the company, now projecting that Salix could report as much as $790 million in revenue by 2013. Goldman Sachs states that it does and seeks to do business with companies covered in its research reports. Salix will expand into nearly 12,000 square feet in its headquarters on Six Forks Road. That will give the company 38,158 square feet in the Colonnade One building. It signed a deal in February to occupy all of the 126,926 square feet in the Colonnade building. Continuing inside, the next article is titled Purdue's Innovation Panel Still Working After 2 Years. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. 2 years after it was set up by Governor Beverly Perdue, a 33-member Innovation Council is still looking at options to give the state a more competitive edge in economic development. The group, co-chaired by venture capitalist Steve Nelson, continues to hold periodic meetings, the most recent about a month ago. Updated topics of conversation have included ways to solve the access to capital conundrum facing many North Carolina business startups. The group's membership is a who's who of business and government movers and shakers, including North Carolina Biotech Center President Taurus Nelson, Secretary of Commerce Keith Christo, Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox, Duke University Medical Center CEO Dr. Victor Dezal, and others. After holding a series of meetings throughout 2010, the council drafted a shopping list of 10 initial recommendations. If adopted, the plan would have cost around $51 million in the form of tax credits and recurring and one-time appropriations. Funded would have been various businesses, mentoring and outreach programs, expanded research and development and business investment tax credits, more seed capital for green startups, and the creation of a talent database, an innovation nonprofit. The recommendations didn't get far when it was submitted last spring to the General Assembly, which was absorbed with other issues, primarily how to make up a $2 billion gap on the revenue side of the state budget. Our 10-point plan percolated up, but I'm not sure how much traction it has gained, says Councilmember Tim Junkie, head of the statewide and Piedmont Triad Investment Micro Angel Fund. By the time lawmakers left Raleigh at the close of the legislative session in the summer, they had adopted plans for $467 million in direct business tax relief over the next 2 years and, for the most part, left the Innovation Council's agenda on the cutting room floor. I can't speak for the whole group, says Karen Levert, council member and CEO of Durham-based Southeast Technoventures, but I felt good about the recommendations we made. They represented a lot of change. I can see how some people would have liked to have seen more happen, but change takes time. Attempts to reach Nelson for comment were not successful. State Representative Joe Tolson, a Pine Tops Democrat, says the group is now meeting quarterly. The group is looking to refine its recommendations as well as add new ones, perhaps in time for the 2012 legislative sessions. "We're trying to find what might work in the conditions we are now under," says Tolson. "We're looking at what sorts of things we can do, unique to North Carolina, whether it's with our recruiting methods or incentives. We're looking for something that works." Councilmember Janke also holds out hope that the group ultimately will live up to its name. "There are still a lot of good people on this council, and as long as we keep proceeding some of its ideas will come up and come to fruition, though I don't know which ones." And now, with state incentives attractive, solar firm plots its growth. By Chris Bagley. From Chapel Hill. "Since September, Strata Solar has developed and installed enough solar generating capacity to power about 6,500 homes, and an array it's planning to install in Chatham County will be the first of several that it expects to power continued growth in 2012. Already, the Chapel Hill Company is by far the largest solar developer in North Carolina, a state that's racing ahead of its neighbors to become the South leader in renewable energy generation. Strata now employs about 30 people at its two-story headquarters a couple of miles south of downtown Chapel Hill. Several dozen more work in the field when installations are in full swing. That's the state of the sector these days. Strata designed and installed a solar array of 900 kilowatts near Boone, which went live in September and is sufficient to power about 800 homes. Strata arrays of 1.2 megawatts each went live in October near Mount Airy and in Person County, north of Durham. Typically, it takes about 1.1 kilowatts to power a single home for about a year. A solar farm near Shelby with 22,500 panels and 5 megawatts of capacity spread across several acres will be one of the largest in the state, Strata CEO and owner Marcus Wilhelm says he expects it to be completed by the end of November. Chatham County planning officials are scheduled to review Strata's next project at Strata-owned property on Farrington Point Road near Jordan Lake on November 21st. Commercial solar farms and arrays have gotten a big boost from the state's renewable energy portfolio standards, passed in 2007, which require investor-owned utilities such as Progress Energy and Duke Energy to derive 7.5% of their electricity from renewable resources by 2021. Of that, at least 0.2 percent points must be solar energy. Progress spokesman Scott Sutton says his company attracts for most of its solar energy with specialty energy companies such as Strata, which lease or occasionally buy land for solar farms. Wilhelm emphasizes the distinction between the solar set-aside and the other 7.3%. He says Strata is one of the few solar companies large and efficient enough to produce solar energy at costs that allow it to compete with wind, hydro, and biomass producers. Prices of photovoltaic silicon-based panels, and therefore the cost of producing the electricity, is falling, another factor that Wilhelm says is likely to help Strata thrive, even after federal and state tax incentives eventually disappear. In contrast to coal and nuclear plants, dams, and even windmills, solar panels and the 1.25 megawatt transformers can be installed and added as more space becomes available, Wilhelm says. Solar is easy to incrementalize, he says. Photovoltaic solar arrays in North Carolina now have about 144 megawatts in total generating capacity, according to the North Carolina Sustainable Energy Association's review of state regulatory filings. About 64 megawatts of capacity went live from January 1 to October 31st, according to Miriam Markhum, who studies renewable industries for the association. Strata accounted for about 31% of that, she says, and accounts for about a quarter of what's on the drawing boards for the first few months in 2012. It's planning for the big time, McCoon says of the company. The association counts 87 projects of at least 500 kilowatts, mostly from Strata and other specialty solar developers. Another 1,400 solar installations are in service, mostly atop the roofs of retail offices, office buildings, government buildings, and homes. Many of those are eligible for Progress Energy's SunSense programs, which cover installation costs for solar panels atop homes and pays fixed rates for production by residential and commercial customers. Progress, the primary electricity producer in Wake County, points east, and the Asheville area has made a conscious decision to source from contractors in order to spur on solar entrepreneurs, Sutton says. Duke, in contrast, owns many of the solar arrays that feed into its electrical grid. The expected merger of the two companies' corporate structures is unlikely to change those two philosophies because the operating utilities will initially remain separate, Sutton says. And now it's time for A Better World, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. The Pope Group steps up for Step Up. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. When the John William Pope Foundation celebrates its 25th anniversary at a dinner December 3rd, all proceeds will benefit Step Up Ministry. The choice of Step Up, which hopes to get as much as $300,000 from the event, reflects the mission and philosophy of the foundation and its founder and namesake, says Art Pope, the foundation's chairman and president. Step Up focuses on taking those individuals that don't have the job skills or training or are already in poverty and providing them with these skills they need to get their first job. Get that first step up on the first rung of the ladder to provide for themselves and to escape poverty, says Pope. The foundation, which had nearly $136.8 million in assets and made just over $9 million in grants in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2010, has made grants totaling $89 million since it opened in 1986. The foundation works to improve its mission of improving the lives of the people of North Carolina through direct support of nonprofits and higher education, and by supporting research and advocacy groups that promote free market public policies that enable people to provide for themselves and for future generations, their children, our children, says Pope, who is chairman, CEO, and president of Variety Wholesalers, and a powerful and controversial player and financial backer in North Carolina politics. Just over half of the foundation's total funding in the past 25 years has supported public policy work in North Carolina, with over half of those funds, or nearly $25 million, supporting the John Locke Foundation, a Raleigh think tank. In the fiscal year ended June 30, 2010, the Pope Foundation gave $2.61 million to the Locke Foundation. A total Pope compares to the nearly $2.7 million the Winston-Salem-based Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation gave the same fiscal year to the North Carolina Justice Center, a progressive research and advocacy group. Another 18% of the foundation's funding over the years has supported higher education, mainly in North Carolina, including $5.7 million to Campbell University and $5 million to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, while 17% has supported national public policy work by conservative groups such as the Heritage Foundation, Cato Institute, Institute for Justice, a public interest litigation group. The remaining 10% of the foundation's funding, or roughly $1 million, in the fiscal year ended June 30, 2010, has supported community philanthropy in North Carolina, mainly in Wake County and mostly in the form of operating support. The foundation, for example, supports local groups such as Habitat for Humanity of Wake County, Food Bank of Eastern and Central North Carolina, Salvation Army, and American Red Cross. The foundation's support of groups like Step Up Ministry addresses the symptoms of poverty, Pope says, while its support of policy groups like the Locke Foundation reflects its long-term solution for poverty by promoting a free market economy that provides jobs, creates growth, so that each generation does better than the previous generation. And now from the opinion page. The guest column today is Len Longwood, Linwood Long. Mr. Long is the president and CEO of the Support Center in Durham, a statewide nonprofit that partners with the Community Development Credit Unions and community-based organizations to provide small business and mortgage lending services to its members. Mr. Long writes, "The recent bank transfer day, the latest call to action by the Move Your Money and Occupy movement to get people to disinvest from the largest Wall Street banks, has sparked a long-awaited dialogue about the financing options that exist outside traditional banks. Amid this frustration and growing anti-bank sentiment, many people are taking the movement's call to heart and are moving their funds from banks to credit unions that provide the same financial services as banks, often at a lower cost. Over the weekend, credit unions across the state reported a surge in new accounts that they say are tied directly to bank transfer day, as well they should. Numbering 7,000 nationally and 100 across North Carolina, credit unions are a viable, safe, and alternative for access to credit, borrowing, checking accounts, and opportunities for savings and wealth building. In addition, they help to generate jobs and economic development in communities across the state. For more than 20 years, the Support Center, a nonprofit certified community development financial institution, has supported and promoted the benefits of working with credit unions. But our voice has often been drowned out by the advertisements of traditional banks. As member-owned institutions, credit unions have reinvested their earnings back into the communities they serve instead of paying out dividends and advertising. Take, for example, Community Development Credit Unions, or CDCUs. Though most people are not aware of them, for decades they have been a vital source of sound financial services and financial literacy to those most vulnerable to the predatory practices that created the housing bubble and led to the Great Recession. Those served by CDCUs include people who have been denied services from traditional banks due to difficulties meeting banks' underwriting standards. Lack of collateral and problems with credit history mean that individuals and small businesses in underserved communities cannot access the necessary financing for home ownership or entrepreneurship, two important keys to achieving the American dream. The Support Center works with local CDCUs and community-based organizations to give these individuals professional yet personal service. In many of these cases, CDCUs are the only place people can turn to make their dreams a reality. As the harsh side effects of the Great Recession persist, the role of CDCUs and credit unions will be paramount to North Carolina's economic recovery. In this economic movement in which job creation will be the key to a broadly shared economic recovery, CDCUs will be instrumental in filling this gap and providing the spark for much-needed economic development. The Support Center's programs and work with CDCUs help our communities grow and thrive. The Occupy movement and Move Your Money have long provided a necessary and long-awaited dialogue on banking options and alternatives to Wall Street. And finally, voices like the Support Centers and CDCUs are starting to be heard. The future of the Occupy movement may be uncertain, but credit unions and CDCUs are well-established institutions across the nation. Looking for a corporate relocation site in North Carolina? There's an app for that. The North Carolina Department of Commerce has created a mobile application for economic development that allows site selectors to search available properties across the state. Called Access NC, the mobile app is a free download and is available for iPhones and iPads. Android and BlackBerry Touch versions are due out soon, according to an announcement by Commerce Secretary Keith Crisco. AccessNC allows users to create client lists and map driving directions from any location to a building or site. It also has a communication sharing feature to send links to coworkers and clients. Fidelity Investments is teaming with Junior Achievement of Eastern North Carolina to establish an economics curriculum at Reedy Creek Middle School in Cary. Called Economics for Success, it's a 6-week program co-taught by Fidelity employees and NC State University students. It explores personal finance, decision-making strategies, and how to use credit wisely, as well as students' education and career options based on their skills, interests, and values. Lucas Metropolis is a 19-year-old Duke University student who decided to do something good for children being treated for serious diseases at Duke University Hospital and their parents. Metropolis founded Fishing for Families in Need when he was 15. Through the program, Metropolis and other Duke student volunteers take parents and kids out for a day of fishing to give them a needed change of scenery, reports the Herald Sun. "It's working," he says. "You wouldn't think that something as simple as fishing could bring people so much enjoyment." Wonder if big fish stories come as part of the program. Baker Renewable Energy, a division of Baker Roofing Company in Raleigh, is collaborating with MIMS Distributing Company to build a 320-kilowatt solar rooftop system on MIMS Distribution Center in Raleigh. Company officials say it will be the largest private rooftop solar system in Wake County. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRS website momentarily. The web address is trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long, until next time.